Welcome to Context TV. Our guest today at the Muffatwerk in Munich is Srećko Horvat. He is an author and activist born in former Yugoslavia. His latest book, together with Slavoj Žižek, is called What Does Europe Want? Last year, he co-founded, together with Yanis Varoufakis, the former finance minister of Greece, DM25, Democracy in Europe Movement 25.
We welcome you to Context TV, Srećko Horvat.
Vielen Dank für die Einladung.
You founded DM25 together with Yanis Varoufakis. We interviewed Yanis Varoufakis in February last year. What has become of the movement since then? I mean, this project was very ambitious in scope. However, up to now, there is hardly a large European movement visible.
Well, the project is even more ambitious now than it was 1 year before. And the situation changed a lot in the course of this year since Diem was founded and launched at Berlin's Volksbühne in February 2016. The situation changed so much that you had Brexit in the meantime, that you had the so-called refugee crisis in the meantime, that now you have Trump, and now this year you will have French, Dutch and German elections and the rise of the extreme right. Of course, Diem or a pan-European movement has to adapt to all these new developments, which almost no one could predict, actually, at that time. So our plans became even more ambitious, which is the reason why DiEM is at the moment working on a refugee policy, on a pan-European refugee policy, because we think the European refugee policy completely failed. I just came to Munich from Belgrade. At Belgrade's main railway station, you have more than 2,000 people living in really, really bad conditions with minus 10, minus 15 degrees, without the possibility of shower or something like that. And really, Belgrade at the moment is becoming the new Calais. Why is it Belgrade becoming a new Calais? Because Europe outsourced the problem of refugees to the periphery. The same is the Turkish European deal, and I could go on and on. So the European refugee policy failed, and again, it's connected to the European foreign policy, which actually doesn't exist. European foreign policy could be summed up as export, import, export. First we export wars, then we import refugees, and then we export the refugees again back to the peripheral countries of Europe. So this is one big important field where DiEM is active, developing at the moment a refugee policy paper. At the same time, the paper on transparency, and at the same time, which will be promoted and published very soon in the course of a couple of months, is the European New Deal, where precisely DiEM, a team which was gathered by Yanis Varoufakis, where you have renowned economists like Jamie Galbraith, Joseph Stiglitz and others, are creating a policy paper, a suggestion for managing the banking crisis, for managing the common currency, the fiscal pact and all the the structural problems of the Eurozone. So DiEM will be active in the French elections, in the German elections, in the Dutch elections. We are very active in UK. And the best thing is that since the launch of DiEM in 2016, thousands of people joined DiEM. We have hundreds of groups all over Germany, all over France, all over Spain, precisely under the same conviction that all these problems which I named, the refugee crisis, wars, we could also add the ecological crisis, cannot be solved at the national level anymore. They can only be solved on an international level. And to reach the international level, we first have to create the European level. And precisely the European level, what you can see with the European crisis, is something where the European elites failed tremendously. They didn't create a European identity, they didn't create European citizenship, and they didn't create the possibility of Europeans deciding together where this continent wants to go.
And how have other groups reacted to DiEM25? I mean, unions or anti-globalization groups and so on and so forth. So are you in contact with them?
Yes, we are in daily contact with different groups. We are in contact with political parties. We have very good contacts to the Linke in Germany, to the Greens in Hungary, to the Labour Party in Britain, to Podemos in Spain. But as you can see, DiEM doesn't want to stay only on the level of party politics, which is a reason that we also established good contacts with the Blockupy movement, for instance, in Germany, with trade unions. So what DiEM is trying to do is different than a horizontal movement and is also different than a vertical political party. We are trying to combine the local level, which is a reason that people from Barcelona, Gerardo Pissarello, Ada Colau, are very close to DiEM, and we are following what's happening there with the cooperatives, with evictions, that we think that the municipal local level is important as the international level as well. And we don't fetishize neither the local level, the national or the international. We are trying to combine it. And at the same time, we are trying to combine what we, in theory, could call horizontality and verticality. So it's a very ambitious experiment, but I think only if we all work together, progressive political parties, progressive movements, trade unions, but also people in technology, people or so-called ordinary people, there is a chance. And in this sense, I think it's very important to say that DiEM is, from the very beginning, opposed to something what is now called, in a jargon, after Brexit, which is called Lexit. So the leftist idea that by exiting the Eurozone you can return to the ideal notion of sovereignty. We think this is a joke. We think this is a dangerous illusion because, as I said, all these problems which we face today in Europe are problems on a much higher supranational level. And we have seen from the defeat of Syriza what happens even when a radical left party takes government. They cannot change the situation on a national level because their problems are problems which have to do with the Eurozone.
Large parts of the EU are turning to right nationalism in Poland, in Hungary, also in Croatia, as well in Austria, France, the Netherlands, Scandinavian countries and Germany. Why is that so? After devastating decades of neoliberalism, why is there not a turn to progressive movements and progressive alternatives?
Well, I think we have to say it explicitly, this is a failure of the left. This is a failure of the left because it was precisely the Nigel Farages, the Le Pens of Europe who succeeded to mobilize the angry workers who are unemployed or who are afraid of the refugees. And the left didn't succeed to do that. To give you a parallel, what happened in Egypt in 2011 was tremendous. Millions of people gathered at Tahrir Square protesting against Mubarak, protesting for more democracy, more freedom of expression, and economical development, if you want. What happened later, if you remember, was that the Muslim Brotherhood came to power after Mubarak. And why was that? It was because the Muslim Brotherhood, during the rule of Mubarak, when they were completely marginalized and even prohibited by law, it was the Muslim Brotherhood for decades provided aid, medicine, loans, clothes to the poor people of villages all around Egypt. It wasn't the left. Traditionally, it was the role of the left, with the workers' movement, with the trade union movements, with the women's liberation movement. It was precisely the left which would go from village to village, from town to town, from city hall to city hall, working with ordinary people and getting them on their side. I think we, and I say we, it doesn't only mean left, but the Democrats failed precisely in that. And it has to do as well with the collapse of the welfare state, I would say. That's the reason why even in Western countries, which had a functioning model of welfare state, you have today the rise of the extreme right. Because precisely this role, which I described, was provided by the welfare state. And when you had the welfare state, which of course was a historical compromise between capital and labor, and was a way to, you know, to move the attention of the workers from the October Revolution, and it was a kind of compromise. But again, it's still much better than what we have today. But when you had the welfare state, you at least had social services. You had a functioning healthcare system. You had free education, and you had pensions, something which is completely unimaginable today. So today, in countries which had all of this, even in Croatia, which was formerly a socialist regime, today we have to pay education. We have to pay healthcare. My generation, in the mid-30s, we don't even believe that we will ever have a pension anymore. So in this situation, of course, a huge amount of people in all countries all over Europe, even in US, as you could have seen with the rise of Trump, are getting unsatisfied and they are getting angry. And it is not the left who is providing an answer, but it is the right. So I think the left and the liberals and the Democrats have to wake up finally, because I think the moment where we are today is a very dangerous moment, where you could imagine a Europe which was completely unimaginable years ago, where you will have Britain, which is not part of the Eurozone anymore, you will have Le Pen in power, and maybe France, which is not part of Europe anymore, which means the complete disintegration of European Union if France exits. You will have Trump, you will have new wars in Syria and Libya, which are taking place all the time. You will have new refugee crisis. So I think the situation is very dire. And instead of retreating to our small national cocoons, we have to fight for a new international. We have to fight for new connections between movements, between, if you want, media as well, between trade unions, between political parties, instead of what Freud would call narcissism of small differences, which means that you and me don't have so much differences, but instead of focusing on our commonalities, on the things which we agree, you and me will focus on the things which differ us. And if we start from that assumption, of course, all of us in any room could immediately exit the room, because there are so many things on which we will not agree. So I think what we have to do is to focus on the things on which we agree and build a progressive international all around Europe, but also in the world.
Which potentials do you see for progressive movements and parties, for example, Podemos in Spain, or the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn in Great Britain, or progressive parts of Italy's Five Star Movement?
Well, I wouldn't put them all together. For instance, I wouldn't put the Five Star Movement together in the same basket as Labour or Podemos, especially because of their stance toward the Eurozone, but also the recent development with the European Parliament, where they wanted to join the one group, but they were rejected. So I think Five Star Movement, we have to see what will happen with them. Podemos and Labour Party, I think what is crucial is that these parties stay in contact with the movements. If there is one lesson of Syriza, one of the lessons, there are many lessons, of course, is that new political parties, if they want to be really new political parties, have to stay in direct contact with the movements. And on the other hand, I wouldn't go on only that way, if Occupy Wall Street has one lesson, it's that occupations, horizontal movements, also need political parties. So to use a philosophical jargon, I think we need a sort of dialectics between horizontality and verticality, in the sense that it is movements which can strengthen the political parties more, and it is political parties which can then implement some of the requests of the movements. And it has to be here all the time in order to avoid corruption or something which happened with the Lange Marsch durch die Institutionen in Germany, for instance. So that's one of the lessons. The rise of the Labour Party in UK is very interesting, because the Labour Party, with more than half million of members, is currently the biggest centre-left party all over Europe. And I think there is potential there. There is potential with Podemos as well. But I think what is necessary now, and that's one of the functions, one of the aims of Democracy in Europe Movement 25, DiEM, is to provide links and infrastructure for all these political parties, but also the movements. Because the problem of Brexit is not a British problem. It's a European problem as well. The problem of Spain, the problem of the Italian referendum or the refugee crisis is something where we all have to come together and work together in order to solve it. I think that's another step these political parties have to achieve, not only to build political alliances in the European Parliament or whatsoever, but to really work together, perceiving that they are part of the same movement and not only political parties on a national level.
Talk about the situation in Greece after the Syriza government surrendered to the blackmailing of the Troika in summer 2015. What is the economic and humanitarian situation, also concerning refugees in Greece? What does Syriza do right now? And which role do protests against Syriza's austerity policy play in this?
I can tell you this from my own experience, since I was there during the Ochi referendum, which in my perception, was one of the most important referendums which, since the forming of the European Union, because 62% of the population decided to say no to austerity measures, and then what happened afterwards was a typical line from Bertolt Brecht's poem, where he says the government wasn't satisfied with the votes of the people, so they decided to change the people. And it's the same what happened after the Ohrid referendum. The 62% of the votes were just turned into to the opposite. Recently, when I was in Greece...
But the government was a troika.
And the government was Syriza. You couldn't say that Syriza doesn't bear a responsibility, but of course it was under the influence and pressure of the Troika. But there was a different way at that time. Recently, when I was in Greece, I could see with my own eyes the consequences of this third memorandum and the surrender of Syriza. First of all, you asked about the refugee crisis, but it's also connected to the economical crisis. So first of all, I went to Idomeni, which became infamous for more than 15,000 people occupying the railways. And, well, it was a humanitarian crisis as well. Then the Balkan route was closed, and it is still closed, although some people, like in Belgrade, the new Calais of Europe, are completely entrapped, living in a kind of limbo, not knowing what to do and not being able to even travel anywhere or to reach so-called Western Europe. After the Balkan route was closed, these people from Idomeni were dispersed in different refugee camps all over Greece, where they again live in a kind of limbo. But how is the refugee crisis connected to the economical crisis? You can see it precisely in Idomeni and in Calais. So in Idomeni, I talked to one director of the Greek National Railway Company. They explicitly said, we get rid of the 15,000 refugees because they started to become a problem for the free floating of goods. When I talked to someone who works for the Eurostar company in Calais, he said we had to get rid of the refugees from Calais for the very precise reason, because the refugees who wanted to enter the trains became a problem for the free circulation of capital. So today in Calais you have the most sophisticated surveillance system, which I've never seen. Me visiting any of the refugee camps I visited, and I visited a lot of refugee camps, with even drones flying around. And when I talked to one employee of the Eurostar company, he was so proud to say, behind us there was a fence, and he was so proud to say these are not NATO standard fences. So when people protest against the G20 in Hamburg or wherever, these are the fences. So they're proud to do that. And then you come back to Idomeni. Even the refugees said, and that's what I like with the refugees, they have this kind of class consciousness. They said, if we were occupying the fields, nothing would happen. By occupying the railways every day, we were at least visible, because we know this is the most important railway where the goods come from Greece to Western Balkans. But the situation goes even deeper. Where do the goods come from? The goods come from mainly from Port Piraeus. Whose is Port Piraeus today? 67% belong to the Chinese. Why does 67% of Port Piraeus belong to the Chinese today? It is because of Alexis Tsipras and Syriza. And the Troika, of course. So today, under Syriza... They sold it to the Chinese. And I went there. I was there when the workers were striking for 1 month. And you know what they said to me? Go to the Chinese part of the port, which is now even the bigger part, which was functioning that time because there was no strike. And they say, yeah, there is no strike there because striking is prohibited. It's prohibited to form trade unions. They have lower wages. There is no collective bargaining and so on. So you have China inside of Greece. And then, under the Syriza government, 14 important airports were sold to Fraport, to Germany. So what you have is an economical crisis, which is even deepening, new privatizations, new unemployment. On the other hand, you have the refugee crisis, which is connected to the economic crisis. And again, I don't think this can be solved on the national level. Syriza cannot solve this, I think, because this is connected to the Eurozone and it's connected to geopolitics. Why is China penetrating Europe? Why are the Arabs building a new Dubai in Belgrade? Why are Arabs so present in Bosnia, for instance? Why are Russians now using Belgrade and Serbia in this big reshuffling where more arms arrived to Eastern Europe since the collapse of the Berlin Wall from the US. Because Europe became a battleground for geopolitics, I think, and it is precisely because of the failure of the European project that this is possible, that it's possible that one of the most important ports in Europe, which is Port of Piraeus, is now Chinese, that it's possible that, you know, you already have Putin in the stomach of Europe, like in Serbia, that you have United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Saudi Arabs, who influence the economic situation in Europe. So, yeah, it was a long answer, but what I want to show is that the refugee crisis is connected to the economic crisis, that left-wing political parties are doing the opposite of what they promised before they came to power, which is not anything new, but that the situation is really, really, really worrying, with a lot of contradictions, which are all contradictions of capitalism.
What is your view on the future of the euro and the European Union? Should we abandon the euro in order to save the European project? Is there a way for progressive policies within the framework of the neoliberal EU treaties and a euro that works mainly for German exports and financial elites?
Yeah, that's completely true that Germany is they have most benefits of this current project of the European Union, and that the euro mainly serves Germany. Look at Slovenia, for instance, which was part of Yugoslavia. They adopted the euro. They faced a huge financial crisis several years ago. They still didn't get out of the financial crisis. I'm the first one to say that the euro doesn't function, and that from the very beginning it has flaws. How do you call it? It doesn't function, and the structure of the euro is mistakenly structured, to say it like that. But at the same time, I don't think that the return to national currencies can function, and that by the return to the national currency, you can immediately get out of the crisis. I'm very skeptical about that as well, because I don't believe that today it's possible to exit global capitalism. I don't believe that by advocating national sovereignty, you will really achieve national sovereignty. This was the illusion of our leftist comrades from Britain, of our leftist comrades from Greece, who believed that by exiting the Eurozone, you will finally, or Europe, European Union, you will finally achieve this kind of state which will be independent of capital. So imagine, Greece exited the Eurozone, returned to the drachma, and what would you have today? Again, you would have even more Chinese companies in Greece, which are not necessarily better than European companies, because at least in European companies you still have the possibility to form trade unions, to have collective bargaining, or to have worker strikes. So I think that the problem is not so much the euro or the Eurozone, but global capitalism. So if we don't want to talk about global capitalism, we should also be quiet about euro.
Last year, the Balkans got a lot of media attention. There was a lot of coverage about the so-called Balkan route, mm-hmm. on which a lot of refugees tried to reach northern parts of Europe. But else, we rarely hear about what is going on in the Balkans economically, socially, politically. So what is the situation right now in Croatia, in Bosnia or Serbia, many years after the Yugoslav wars in the 1990s ended?
The situation is very depressive. The situation is similar to the situation of other peripheral countries of the European Union, except that what you have in Croatia, in Slovenia, in Serbia mainly, is the worst kind of historical revisionism. Where even the anti-fascist struggle, which liberated this region, it was the first liberated region, territory during the Nazi regime, which already took most of Europe, that even anti-fascism is being reinterpreted in a bad manner, that it's impossible to speak publicly about the victory of anti-fascism. You have right-wing governments all over, which are at the same time neoliberal governments. You have mass unemployment. I think Croatia today is the third, just after Greece and Spain, when it comes to the unemployment of the youth. Every second Croatian between 20 and 30 is unemployed. So you have brain drain, emigration, which is not only economical emigration, it's also political emigration in a way. And you have a situation that a territory which was once a territory with the current numbers of the rise of GDP, which China has, 7 or 8%, now is in economic recession already for years.
That was in the Yugoslav period.
During the Yugoslav period, we had factories, we had a free public healthcare system, we had free public education, which meant that if you go to the university, you don't have to take a loan, which you have to take today, for instance, like the American system, in order to study. We had natural resources, which belonged to Yugoslavia, which means water resources, woods, forests, and so on. There are no factories from Vienna to Athens today. If you go by car, you will find almost no factories anymore. Before the 90s, Yugoslavia was one of the biggest producers of cars in Europe, of different sorts of products. Yugo, of course, Zastava, Končar, I could name the companies. Most of these companies don't exist anymore. And it goes even so far that once these companies were privatized, and it already started in the 80s, we could talk about that as well, already during Yugoslavia. But once the industry was privatized, once the factories were privatized, then came a new period at the end of the 90s, beginning of 2000, when the banks started to be privatized. So now today in Croatia, 90% of the banks are not Croatian anymore, but Italian, French, and so on, which then again, with the Italian referendum, you will see that that has consequences of on Croatia as well. And it's not only Yugoslavia. I was recently in Romania, for instance, at a mountain in Transylvania, 2,000 meters high, where you have the biggest number of clear cuts in Europe. Why? Because an Austrian company called Schweighofer is exporting the woods to Western Europe. So again, you have something which you already had in this territory during the Austro-Hungarian monarchy. Because during the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, it was Bosnia, Croatia, parts of Serbia, Romania, which served as the periphery to the center. And you have a parallel again here. It is the same today in the current architecture of the European Union, where these countries, the peripheral countries, again serve as, as a territory for extraction of value, as a territory for extraction of cheap labor, as a territory of extraction for natural resources. So all over the Balkans now, for us it was really normal that you switch off the pipe and you drink water. I mean, that's the most normal thing. Some people still do it today, which is a surprise to me. Today, you have bottled water all over Yugoslavia. And I remember when I was a child in the 90s with my friends, in a park, we were all talking about this dystopian future where people will drink bottled water. Well, you have it today. And it is Coca-Cola and Western companies from Germany or France who own water resources. It is companies who own forests. And the worst thing is that now so-called immaterial stuff like education or healthcare is also being privatized. So in the way, I think the situation in ex-Yugoslavia and the Balkans is even worse than in other countries, because we had the experience of decades of real existing socialism, let's call it like that, which was a better variant of Soviet socialism, where we had free healthcare, where we had free education, where we didn't have to buy water, where we had industries, where we had factories. If you come to the Balkans today, it's a wasteland. It's a wasteland where you don't have anything. You don't have factories, people are unemployed, people have to pay for education, people have to pay for healthcare. People of my generation, they will never have pensions because it won't exist. And at the same time, you have the rise of historical revisionism and the extreme right. So, well, I wouldn't say this is much different than the rest of Europe, but the difference is that at least we had an experience of a system which was functioning better, at least for the mass, for the majority of the population, which at least had the basic services, which were, state-owned, and which served them in the terms of education, healthcare, and other things which people don't have anymore in the Balkans.
You call the image of the Balkans as a violent place of savages not capable of living together a myth. You rather see a great pool of solidarity and a great tradition of solidarity in the Balkans. Please explain what you mean by that.
The collapse of Yugoslavia has a lesson for not only Yugoslavia, but for Europe and for the world. Because I think what we should do today is to turn around the classical thesis that the collapse of Yugoslavia happened because of nationalism. That's always what you will find, you know, Serbs fighting Croats, Croats fighting Serbs, someone raping someone, someone killing neighbors and so on, because, you know, the Balkans is the unconscious of Europe and all we know what to do. All what we do is to rape, kill, and so on. And you can see it in Emir Kusturica's movies, this kind of romanticization of the Balkans as, you know, a place of savages, which was deconstructed by Maria Todorov in her perfect book, Imaginary Balkans. So this perception of Balkans still exists, and this interpretation of the collapse of Yugoslavia as a consequence of nationalism still goes all around. But what is the lesson which we can learn from the collapse of Yugoslavia? And I think it's very important. I think this thesis has to be turned around on the head. Because what I would say is that the collapse of Yugoslavia wasn't the consequence of nationalism, but nationalism was the consequence of the collapse of Yugoslavia. What does it mean? If you look back, and here we have to go into political economy, Yugoslavia wasn't destroyed because of nationalism, but Yugoslavia collapsed because of the internal contradictions the self-management project of socialism in Yugoslavia already had from the 60s and the 70s. You will see that Yugoslavia already in the 70s became integrated into the global market, that it couldn't resolve some of the contradictions. For instance, one of the contradictions in a socialist regime, which is of course not a contradiction in a capitalist regime, is that the surplus value was going already in the 70s during Tito's rule was going to an autonomous financial sector. So the banks already in the 70s, which is the period of financialization all over the world, the banks became the leader of that economic system. And then, which is not really known in the West, because not so many books are published in English, is that already in 79, Yugoslavia took the first loan from the International Monetary Fund during Tito's rule. And when Tito died, 1 month later, Yugoslavia went into history as the biggest loan the IMF gave to that date. Why is that important? Because already in the 80s then, we had something what we can see today in the periphery of Europe, austerity measures, privatizations. What you can see today in Portugal, in Greece, in Spain, we already had in Yugoslavia in the 80s. So the first period of deindustrialization starts during the communist rule in the 80s. Workers go to the streets. You have a great PhD dissertation by someone called Jake Lowinger, who was a student of Giovanni Arrighi, and who shows how in the 80s, the number of worker strikes all around Yugoslavia was rising to a degree that in 87, you have an annual number of worker strikes more than 1,000 or something like that. So imagine that today in the European Union, you have more than 1,000 worker strikes in 1 year. What would happen? It would probably collapse. And this is precisely what happened with Yugoslavia. But why is it important to come back to your question about the rise of right-wing movements? What you can see here is that the first movement against austerity was a leftist movement, and all these workers were protesting together. It's important in the Yugoslav context. You had Bosnian people, you had Muslims, you had Orthodox people, and you had Christians. So you had Serbs, Bosnians, Croatians protesting together against austerity measures in order to preserve the self-management socialist system. And then what happened? To cut a long story short, a guy who was a banker, who was a director of a Serbian bank, and who was also in the US as a broker, called Slobodan Milošević, comes back to Yugoslavia and uses the workers' strikes to turn it into a nationalist movement. So what you have is that precisely the austerity measures created deindustrialization, mass unemployment. The workers are unsatisfied. They still have a progressive agenda, but then the leaders in Croatia it was Franjo Tuđman, in Serbia Slobodan Milošević, and there were others in Bosnia and other parts of ex-Yugoslavia as well, turned it into nationalism. And it was precisely this nationalism which then led to the collapse of Yugoslavia. And why is it an important lesson today? Because what we can see today all around Europe, but also with Brexit and with Trump on the other hand over the Atlantic, is precisely the same model. So you have a failed economic neoliberal policy, which is a question whether it is neoliberalism at all or not, that's also a good question, which brings to mass unemployment, to privatizations, deindustrialization, where Europe is then also losing its geopolitical role. And what you have is a reaction. And we have seen the reaction with Brexit and with Trump. And I think this is something which during 2017 will even increase with the French elections, with the Dutch elections, and with the German elections, with the rise of Front National, AfD, and Geert Wilders. And I think if there is one lesson of the collapse of Yugoslavia, it's that precisely the economical situation, if the left is not advanced enough or organized, will be used by the extreme forces, by the right. And I think we should be really worried about 2017, because I think European Union, we could also go in detail how the Yugoslav system functioned with the center, Serbia, Croatia, and the periphery, Kosovo, and so on, and now also with austerity measures and so on, the future collapse of the European Union resembles to the collapse of Yugoslavia, which happened in the 90s.
Since the outbreak of the financial crisis in 2008, there have been occurred a series of anti-government protests in the Balkans, in Croatia, Slovenia, Bosnia, or Bulgaria. In Macedonia, students mobilized successfully against a restrictive educational reform that morphed into an anti-government movement. There was also resistance against privatization and commercialization of higher education in Croatia. Croatia and experiments with direct democracy in Bosnia, worker strikes, takeovers of companies, and so on and so forth, have also been reinvigorated in some places in the Balkans. Talk about these protests and what is behind them.
It's very interesting because not so many people know that in the Balkans, we had plenums, general assemblies, direct democracy, even before the Occupy Wall Street movement or Indignado started. And I think it has to do with the legacy which we had in Yugoslavia, where we had self-management, for instance, and where we had direct democracy to a certain degree. Of course, it failed. It's a consequence of internal contradictions of the Yugoslav self-management system, but at least we had this legacy. So to understand these movements, and you name just a few of them, but all over Balkans, from Slovenia to Macedonia to Serbia to Bosnia, you had direct democracy movements, you had occupations of factories, you have renewed self-management, a factory in Tuzla, for instance, which still works today, is a self-managed company by workers. At the same time, it was in Bosnia where you had plenums where more than 1,000 citizens gathered and protested against the government. Most recently, it still takes place, and it is one of the most interesting movements in the Balkans today. You have a movement which is called Nedavimo Beograd, which is a movement against the so-called Belgrade on the waterfront. So what is happening now in Belgrade is that the United Arab Emirates invested, I think, more than 2 billion euros or something like that. It's so much that I cannot even repeat it because it's completely abstract. So they want to build a new Dubai in the center of Belgrade with skyscrapers, shopping centers, and so on. And of course, there are dodgy deals with the Serbian Vucic government. So what you had in the last year, 2016, at which we probably continue, is a movement which is able to bring 20,000 people on the streets. Of course, one problem of all these movements is, and it's not a particular Balkan problem, is a European global problem, is what to do the day after. Because today it's not anymore enough to just protest on the streets against the government, and then you will get another government, and then another government, and so on. I think what is interesting in the Balkans is that there is a transformation of some of these movements. So, for instance, in Slovenia, you had a big movement connected to the trade unions, where a new political party, Nova Levica, Združna Levica, was formed out of the movements. Our comrades in Serbia are trying to achieve something similar now for the next local elections in Serbia, where they are building a united front with workers, with freelance journalists. All of them lost their jobs in all the Balkans because of the crisis. And they're trying to create an independent bloc to run the next elections. So what you can see in the Balkans is that the ideas of progressive politics are back, and they are back already for the last 10 years, and they were back even before this movement started to flourish in Spain, in Greece, or in the US. Of course, I don't want to say, you know, this is more important because it was first, but I'm just noticing it because it's interesting. And even when I was in 2011 at Zuccotti Park during the Occupy Wall Street, I have seen guidelines from the student occupation of Croatia 2009 there in their independent library. So it's interesting that you can see that there are connections with other movements as well. So it's not that this protest energy doesn't exist anymore, and it's not that it's not connected.
Last question, what is your assessment of the EU's Balkan policies? And what do you think about the refusal of France and Germany to accept people fleeing from the Balkan countries, especially Sinti and Roma, from the Kosovo?
That's a very complicated question, but I can answer it generally. I think Western countries, and we have seen it now with the refugee crisis, but I would say it goes back to that refugee crisis as well, behave very cynical. And I think the most cynical thing is the differentiation between refugees, asylum seekers, and economical refugees. And I think what they are doing, and it was the same with the Balkans, is that you have different historical sequences which last 4 or 5 years, where some refugees are the good refugees and some refugees are the bad refugees. So now in Belgrade, where almost 2,000 people sleep in the conditions of minus 10 degrees at the main railway station, most of them are, you know, from where? From Afghanistan. But I still remember 5 years ago, the Afghanistan refugees were the good refugees. Today is the Syrians who are the good refugees. And you can probably imagine that in 5 years, the Syrians will be at another railway station somewhere in Kosovo or Macedonia because they are the bad refugees now. And then you come also back to this ideological construct of, on the one hand, asylum seekers, on the other hand, economical refugees, which I think is a complete ideological construct which has to be deconstructed. Because what does it mean? What does it mean? It says that Syrian refugees are correct, good refugees because they are asylum seekers, because they are fleeing war. And at the same time, Afghanistan refugees are economical refugees. Come on, we don't remember anymore that the crisis in Afghanistan happened because of Western interventions, that most of the countries of Africa are in the state that people from Sudan, from Congo, Eritrea have to flee because of decades of economical warfare, because of centuries of colonization. And to say from our European perspective that these refugees are economic refugees and that they are not good refugees and that they cannot get an asylum, I think it's not only cynical, but it's, you know, putting a hand in front of our eyes and not looking at what Europe did with the war in Libya, with the French intervention, for instance, with the war in Syria. But we could also go back to what the Belgians did in Congo. And I think all this has to... Why do we have people from Congo living in Europe? I mean, it goes back to the crisis and colonial period of Congo where more than 10 million people were killed. And to come back to the Balkans, I think the same goes for the Balkans. I mean, if you have mass unemployment in the Balkans today and you say, yes, these are economic refugees, you have to go back and to see why this economic situation was created in the first place. And it again has to do with extractivism, neocolonialism, and the financial crisis, which was in a way a consequence of that as well.
Thanks a lot for the interview.
Thank you.